Welcome to Monday's edition of Financial Survival, sponsored by Discount Gold Silver Trading. I'm Dave Allen. Melody has the day off. For all your gold and silver needs, call us toll-free at 1-800-375-4188. That's 800-375-4188, or look us up on the web at dgscoins.com, dgscoins.com. For the next hour, I'll be bringing you my opinions and commentary on the economic and political news of the day. Today is Tuesday, June 8, 2021. Hello, Todd. Thanks in advance to our producer and engineer. Let's get started with the market report. A lot of craziness in markets today. Now, gold did reach a high of close to 1905 earlier before falling throughout the day and then rising again to close at 1894. Down $6.60. Similar directions for silver, which just about hit $28, but closed at $27.71, down 27 cents. Platinum was down $12 at $11.67, and palladium down $26 at $28.90. Now let's jump to crude oil, which was up 1.4%, up almost a dollar a barrel, 99 cents, in fact, at $70.22 per barrel. In the Treasury markets, all maturities, U.S. Treasury maturities down today. The bellwether 10-year yield at down 0.04 to close at 1.53%. Just for comparison, the 5-year was down 0.24%. Close at 0.769%. Crazy stuff there. The U.S. dollar index, which certainly helps to explain and is consistent with gold and silver's movement today, closed up 0.16 at 90.11. And in the all so popular stock indices, mixed across the world, largely not totally down. In the U.S., the Dow Jones fairly, down 30 and change to close at 34,599. Broader S&P 500 up 0.73 to 42.27, and the tech-laden NASDAQ up 43 and change to close at 13, we'll call it 925. Fixed Volatility Index up 3.8% today. I'm surprised, though, it's just 17.04, given everything that's been going on with meme stocks and inflation fears and overall improving, but really a schizophrenic job market. In any event, that is today's market report brought to you by Discount Gold and Silver Trading. Now, a lot of news, some of it the standard stuff that we bring to you all the time, others some interesting angles on some sidebars of the daily news, which we'll get to in the second and third segments. We're going to start with a record job opening report today. Openings in April soared to a record 9.3 million as the economy rapidly recovered from its pandemic depths. I guess that was a Freudian slip. Sorry about that. The standard set in April was well above the 8.3 million in March. That itself was a new high going back to 2000. That's for the Labor Department's JOLTS report, the so-called Job Openings and Labor Turnover Survey. Now, Fed policymakers closely watched the JOLTS numbers for indications of labor market slack, though the numbers do run a month behind the more widely publicized non-farm payroll counts, which we'll be talking a lot about actually later on in the program. Came out Friday. Markets had been looking for a JOLTS number of around 8.2 million, roughly. Total openings for the month was just below the total considered unemployed. Job availability surged just about 33% in leisure and hospitality. Of course, the sector hurt most by the pandemic lockdowns over the past year. Now, the big jump in job openings came during a month when hiring overall really disappointed. I mean, payrolls increased by just 278,000 at a time when economists had been looking for growth of around a million. That was, of course, in April. And I think last week's numbers for May were about 16% below expectations. However, Labor Department, as we know, we've been reporting since the early part of the pandemic, has struggled with seasonal adjustments in a number of its metrics. And most are saying, the economists it is, that the most recent JOLTS numbers are showing that the job market is poised for strong growth. Of course, one big challenge for employers is finding available labor. You've got child care issues, you've got ongoing fears about the pandemic, even with the surging, but now leveling off of vaccinations. And, of course, the lure of enhanced unemployment benefits have all kept the unemployment rolls at around 10 million, still about 3.5 million higher than before the pandemic started. That level fell to 9.3 million in May, about in line with the job openings. Now, the higher rate for April remained subdued at 69,000, or an unchanged 4.2% from the previous month. Quits, which are seen as a gauge of worker confidence that they can find other employment, rose considerably to just shy of 4 million. That represents growth of about 384,000. It's an increase of 11% that took the quit rates as a share of the labor force up to a record 2.7% from 2.5% the month before. Retail in particular saw a sharp rise in quits up to 4.3% from 3.6%. Total separations, I think that's from all sources, increased to about 5.8 million. That's gained to 324,000. That took that rate up to 4% from 3.8. So more interesting news in that respect. Of course, again, in the last segment of the show, we'll be talking about both Friday's blog and today's newsletter article, both about jobs and the economy and gold and how they all fit together. I know we've been talking an awful lot about cryptocurrencies recently, and today is going to be no difference because Bitcoin's price slipped big again today amid what's being called a brutal sell-off among all digital currencies, or most anyway. The reason for the move was not totally clear. However, consensus is that it's related to investor concerns over security and the safety of cryptocurrency. particularly after U.S. officials managed to recover most of the ransom paid to hackers that targeted Colonial Pipeline just a few weeks ago. Court documents said investigators were able to access the password for one of the hackers' Bitcoin wallets. The money was recovered by a recently launched task force in Washington created as part of the government's response to a rise in cyber attacks in general. Bitcoin accelerated its slide to fall below the $32,000 per coin level late this morning. The world's largest cryptocurrency was trading 9% lower at $32,189 as of 2 o'clock p.m. This afternoon, Eastern time. But smaller digital coins also slumped, with Ether falling about 10% to about 2,441, and XRP tanking over 9%. In April this year, the year in general was looking to be a banner year for digital assets. And I mean, who knows how it'll end up? I mean, there are some coins that are still doing well, with Bitcoin having topped 60,000 for the first time ever. But a recent plunge in crypto prices has begun to shake longer term confidence in that market. Bitcoin sank to almost 30,000 last month and is currently down almost 50% from its all-time high. Still, there are those who believe that it's still destined for incredible six-figure prices. The digital currency is now up only 9% since the start of the year, though it's still more than tripled in price from a year ago. Yesterday, U.S. law enforcement officials said they seized 2.3 million in Bitcoin paid to DarkSide, the cyber criminal gang behind that cyber attack on Colonial. I believe I remember correctly, the total ransom was between 4 and 5 million. According to a court document, the FBI was able to access what's called the private key or password for one of the hackers' Bitcoin wallets. Bitcoin has often been the currency of choice for hackers demanding ransom payments in order to decrypt data locked by malware known as ransomware. Crypto media outlet Decrypt reported there were unfounded rumors that the attacker's Bitcoin wallet had been hacked, which they say is an unlikely scenario. DarkSide, which reportedly received 90 million in Bitcoin ransom payments from all sources before shutting down, operated a so-called ransomware as a service business model where hackers develop and market ransomware tools and sell them to the affiliates who then carry out attacks. According to blockchain analytics firm Elliptic, the seized funds represent the bulk of DarkSide affiliate share of the ransom paid out by Colonial. John Hultquist, VP of Analysis at Mandiant Threat Intelligence, we'll call it MTI, called the move a welcome development. Hultquist said, in addition to the immediate benefits of this approach, a stronger focus on disruption may disincentivize this behavior, which is growing in a vicious cycle. Well, we can hope that that's the case, but I think we're going to need some proof in the pudding. Just last week, thousands of Bitcoin investors descended on Miami for an event billed as the largest Bitcoin event in history. That conference even had a few bizarre highlights, including El Salvador's President Nayib Bukele announcing plans for the country to accept Bitcoin as legal tender. Well, there you have it. Things running amok in Central America. Now, meme stocks, we're at it again. It's continuing. The entertainment company AMC says it has learned its lesson from the meme winter and is determined to use the meme summer to its shareholders' advantage. So AMC might not be able to make money by selling movie tickets, but it seems to be proving itself a master of bringing in money by selling stock certificates. The theater chain has steadily issued new stock, most recently last Thursday, when it sold more than 11 million shares, netting over $500 billion, close to $600 million. That's a half billion, excuse me. More than the entire company's equity value at the beginning of this year. Now, the total number of AMC Class A shares outstanding has risen tenfold, from 50 million this time last year to, listen to this, 500 million today. As a result, the company's market capitalization has risen even faster at 4,945% than its stratospheric share price at 2,160%. When GameStop first started heading to the moon a few months ago, the overwhelming consensus was that the stock had become a pure gambling vehicle that was inevitably going to crash, creating massive losses for people who bought into the hype and didn't get out in time. Those widespread losses overall didn't happen, though. GameStop stock continues to trade at extremely elevated levels, raising the prospect that meme stocks can actually be very risky investments rather than just short-term trades. Once meme stocks become a potential investment, companies can take advantage of that fact by issuing new shares on the capital market, just as other risky companies like Tesla have done. The difference is, well, AMC isn't a technology stock with the potential to dominate the world. It's just a struggling chain of movie theaters. So short sellers beware. The similarity between the two companies is that both have large and enthusiastic retail investor bases. AMC, just like Tesla before it, proof that once retail investors dominate a stock, its trajectory is unlikely to behave in a familiar manner. Bank of America says it's going to stop covering GameStop and plans to suspend its ratings of fellow meme stock Bed Bath & Beyond, saying the shares no longer trade on fundamentals. The bottom line, capital markets, ladies and gentlemen, they're playing by new rules, and regulators are understandably loath to get involved right now, even if there are risks to the public broad faith in efficient markets. Hertz stock, for instance, is now trading on fundamentals at higher levels than it was last year while going through bankruptcy. Well, that about does it for this first segment. We hear the music. It means it's time to go into message land. Please stick around for financial survival.
Since the beginning of the United States, kings have sought it, nations have fought for it. It has been traded, borrowed, purchased, and stolen. There is a reason for it. To secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity, invest with the security of gold and silver. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading at 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Listen to Financial Survival with your host, Melody Cederstrom, on Shortwave Radio. Visit DiscountGoldAndSilverTrading.net or call 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. For the very best in gold and silver trading, call toll-free 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Call now.
Melody Cederstrom and CSE Talk Radio team up as Common Sense Voices of Integrity. I personally endorse Melody Cederstrom to be your trusted go-to expert for all your precious metal needs. Experts agree a financial crisis and even collapse is inevitable. Given our government's lack of economic leadership and self-interests of those in power, it's no longer a question of if you should purchase gold and silver, but if you will purchase gold and silver before it's too late. Melody encourages you to tune in each weekday morning. Visit CSE Talk Radio. TalkRadio.com. We both agree truth and education are the two significant factors in both our missions. There is a wealth of misinformation out there. Let Melody and Beth Ann help you sort through the chaos and bring you home to the truths that will ensure that you and your family are protected. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading, 1-800-375-4188, or online at DGScoins.com. Melody and Beth Ann are strong forces together, working to preserve liberty and bring America home.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to Financial Survival, brought to you by Discount Gold and Silver Trading. I'm Dave Allen, and for Melody today, boy, the federal government's foreclosure moratorium is ending later this month. But that doesn't mean necessarily they're saying that foreclosures are about to come roaring back. The housing market for sure is very tight right now, and people who lose their homes can find it very hard to find somewhere else to live. The good news, however, is that foreclosures are almost certain to remain extremely uncommon until 2022 at the earliest. Now, as the White House's moratorium is ending, the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau is proposing a new rule called Regulation X. Sounds foreboding, and actually the title of a, we'll call it a Netflix movie even. It would effectively ban foreclosures until the end of 2021, while also making it easier to keep borrowers in their homes. Over 7 million homeowners entered pandemic-related forbearance plans over the last 14 months, but most of them have already left that purgatory with homes in hand. According to Black Knight, 46% are now reperforming on their loans, I think, which means they're 30 days or less in arrears. And another 17% have actually paid off their mortgage entirely, either by refinancing it or by selling their house in this very strong market. Although about 2.1 million homeowners still remain in forbearance. Even if they're behind on both mortgage payments and property taxes, the overwhelming majority of those homeowners still have substantial positive equity in their homes, according to Black Knight economist Andy Walton, who says also it's almost the exact opposite of what we saw during the Great Recession. Back then, millions of homeowners were completely underwater on their mortgages, which really limited the options and created a snowball of distress. Now, rising prices create a lot more space for servicers to work out deals that keep borrowers in their home, and that's a good thing. Thus, there's a good possibility that foreclosures will rise above their pre-pandemic level in 2023 once all other options have been tried and once the current backlog of court cases has begun to clear. For the time being, however, experts are saying that foreclosure is one thing that most homeowners don't need to worry about. Let's hope that other 2.1 million find their way out of this mess as well. Now, again, we've been talking a lot about inflation, writing about it in the newsletter and blogs the last few months. In the aftermath of the 2008 subprime crisis, regulators said they were determined to stamp out the kind of funding stresses that had brought the financial system and country to its knees. Efforts at shoring up the system included new liquidity requirements that often required large banks to hold big buffers of, well, supposedly safe and liquid assets that could be used to protect against outflows. These portfolios typically fell under the umbrella of what's called high-quality liquid assets, or HQLA. But another way about thinking, another way of thinking about them is as a form of bank bondage. a requirement that forces banks to keep large amount of generally low-yielding securities like treasuries, which can be used as collateral in the repo market, for example, or agency mortgage-backed securities, MBS, and other reserves on their balance sheets. Like the famous Henry Ford maxim about customers being able to have a car painted any color that he wants so long as it's black, banks are able to tweak their HQLA portfolios as long as they consist solely of the things that fall under the strict regulatory definition of liquid. Never mind, of course, that the rules left banks more intertwined with the repo market in the aftermath of the 2008 crisis. And that's a vulnerability which could, actually did come back and haunt them just last year. You'll typically find HQLA portfolios ebbing and flowing alongside available yield and interest rates. One of the more interesting bits of market moves in the recent past, or lack thereof, has been in treasuries. Yields there have remained stubbornly within ranges, even as concerns over inflation seem to grow alongside the issuance of new debt. There's an argument to be made that the events of last year incentivized banks to snap up treasuries for their HQLA portfolios in a way they haven't really done so before, by buying $350 billion worth of the bonds over the past year or so. In other words, bank bondage could go some way, maybe a long way, towards explaining the apparently sanguine stance of the debt market towards the prospect of higher inflation and larger supply. As the Fed Guy blog puts it, G-SIBs are mandated to hold a sizable HQLA portfolio, but there's some degree of freedom in its composition. The highest quality level one HQLA includes reserves, treasuries, and treasury reverse repos. When reverse repo rates rose above interest on reserves, in 2018, the G-SIBs began reshuffling their HQLA portfolio out of reserves and into reverse repo. Talked a little bit about this last week. Now that interest on reserves is at just 0.1% and reverse repo is at zero, the banks are shuffling their HQLA holdings toward treasuries. Some are also significantly increasing their holding of the mortgage-backed securities, which is a slightly lower quality of HQLA known as level two, actually level 2A, I believe. The implication here is that banks that are buying U.S. treasuries to satisfy liquidity requirements, that's effectively put a lid on yields and potentially stripped them of some informational value regarding exactly what the market thinks of inflation risks. Treasury yields might be agreeing with the Fed that the price pressures are transitory, but they could also be artificially low, thanks to an array of arcane money market rates. The source of demand could change or could disappear entirely, particularly if something were to come along and knock the delicate balance of rates and incentives that's combined to herd the world's biggest bank into all these treasuries. It's worth noting, of course, that the effect of Fed fund rates' slow march towards zero has plenty of people talking about the possibility of the Fed's changing the amount of interest it pays on excess reserves. In fact, I'm surprised that hasn't already occurred. Now, it's time for this week's Levity is Golden. And this is kind of an obscure one of sorts, but an interesting one, I think, for humankind, life in general, we'll say. It looks like MIT engineers have discovered a new way of generating electricity using tiny carbon particles that could create a current simply by interacting with liquid surrounding them. I note here up front, parenthetically, that I got a C in this high school course that I took on this very subject. So I'm an average student with, I'd say, possibly an above average level of fascination with this. So that's why I found this article and its subject matter sort of enticing. Now, this liquid, which is an organic solvent, draws electrons out of the particles, generating a current that could be used to drive chemical reactions or to power micro or even nanoscale robots. That's according to the researchers at MIT. Michael Strano, who's a professor of chemical engineering there, and a senior author of this study, says that this technology is intriguing because all you have to do is flow a solvent through a bed of these particles. This allows you to do electrochemistry, but with no wires. In a new study describing this phenomenon, the researchers showed that they could use this electric current to drive a reaction known as alcohol oxidation. It's an organic chemical reaction that's, well, it's least important in the chemistry, chemical industry. The new discovery grew out of Strano's research on carbon nanotubes, hollow tubes made of a lattice of carbon atoms which have unique electrical properties. That work led Strano and his students to uncover a related feature of carbon nanotubes. They found that when part of a nanotube is coated with a Teflon-like polymer, it creates an asymmetry that makes it possible for electrons to flow from the coated to the uncoated part of the tube, generating an electrical current. Those electrons can then be drawn out by submerging the particles in a solvent that's hungry for electrons. To harness that special capability, the researchers created electricity-generating particles by grinding up carbon nanotubes and then forming them into a sheet of paper-like material. One side of each sheet was coated with a Teflon-like polymer, and the researchers then cut out small particles, which could be any shape or size. For this study, they made particles that were 250 microns by 250 microns. When these particles were submerged in an organic solvent, the solvent adheres to the uncoated surface of the particles and begins pulling electrons out of them. The solvent takes electrons away, and the system tries to calibrate it by moving electrons. That's according to Strano. There's no sophisticated battery chemistry inside. It's just a particle. You put it into solvent, and it starts generating an electrical field. The current version of the particles can generate about 7/10 of a volt of electricity per particle. In this study, the researchers also showed they can form arrays of hundreds of particles in a small test tube. This packed bed reactor generates enough energy to power a chemical reaction called alcohol oxidation, where alcohol is converted into a ketone or an aldehyde. Usually that reaction is not performed using electrochemistry because it would require too much external current. The important thing here is that the particles can be made very small, and they don't require any external wires in order to drive the electrochemical reaction. In future work, Strano hopes to use this kind of energy generation to build polymers using only carbon dioxide as a starting material. In a related project, he's already created polymers that can regenerate themselves using carbon dioxide as a building material in a process powered by solar energy. I mentioned this to my nephew, who's I guess he's known as a process engineer. He said this is a real important development. He's a John Hopkins grad who works with synthetic plastics and ceramics and other materials, several pay grades above mine, ladies and gentlemen. In the longer term, this approach could be used to power micro or nanoscale robots, as I mentioned. Strano's lab has already begun building robots at that scale, which could one day be used as diagnostic or even environmental sensors. He says that the idea of being able to scavenge energy from the environment to power these kinds of robots is incredibly appealing. It means you don't have to put the energy storage on board. What we like about this mechanism is that you can take this energy, at least in part, from the environment itself. And that, ladies and gentlemen, is this week's obscure, not-so-levity is golden. Interesting stuff. Now, the last couple minutes of this segment, the dollar is getting more attention lately. We talked last week about the Soviet Union dropping the dollar as part of its national wealth fund. Essentially, it was used as the basis for its national pension plan. And now we're reading today that the dollar's grip on global trading and financial systems in general since World War II is no longer as assured as it once was. Vladimir Putin took another highly symbolic step in, again, ousting the dollar from Russia's financial system recently, following through in his call to de-dollarize the nation as the standoff with the U.S. intensifies, particularly over sanctions. His country's wealth fund, where the government sends its energy windfall, will now shrink its dollar share to zero and grow holdings instead of euros, yuan, and gold. Nearly all state energy companies have shifted to payments in local currencies with its international partners. That's according to Russia's deputy finance minister. The next step is to change benchmarks into euro, yuan, and so on. And he said the governments are already talking about this. Dmitry Timofeev, who heads the finance ministry department that monitors external restrictions, said this process is rather hard because using the dollar is economically more attractive, adding that the currency trading on the Moscow exchange is still 80% dollars. A recent milestone was Russia's share of exports using the U.S. dollar falling below 50% for the first time ever. That was aided by major oil shipper Rosneft switching export contracts for crude shipments to euros. And trade with China now, between China and Russia, that is now chiefly priced in euros. This Friday, less than 2 weeks before the scheduled face-off, or face-to-face meeting, between Biden and Putin, Putin said the U.S. is using its currency as a political and economic weapon, which is hurting the dollar as a reserve currency. We'll be talking more about this in the coming weeks. In the meantime, we've got a couple more messages. Please stay tuned. You're listening to Financial Survival.
Since the beginning of the United States, kings have sought it, nations have fought for it. It has been traded, borrowed, purchased, and stolen. There is a reason for it. To secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity, invest with the security of gold and silver. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading at 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Listen to Financial Survival with your host, Melody Cederstrom, on Shortwave Radio. Visit DiscountGoldAndSilverTrading.net or call 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. For the very best in gold and silver trading, call toll-free 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Call now.
Melody Cederstrom and CSE Talk Radio team up as Common Sense Voices of Integrity. I personally endorse Melody Cederstrom to be your trusted go-to expert for all your precious metal needs. Experts agree a financial crisis and even collapse is inevitable. Given our government's lack of economic leadership and self-interests of those in power, it's no longer a question of if you should purchase gold and silver, but if you will purchase gold and silver before it's too late. Melody encourages you to tune in each weekday morning. Visit CSE Talk Radio. TalkRadio.com. We both agree truth and education are the two significant factors in both our missions. There is a wealth of misinformation out there. Let Melody and Beth Ann help you sort through the chaos and bring you home to the truths that will ensure that you and your family are protected. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading, 1-800-375-4188, or online at DGScoins.com. Melody and Beth Ann are strong forces together, working to preserve liberty and bring America home.
Oh, boy, I don't know how it is where you are, ladies and gentlemen, but where I am, the clouds are opening and the thunder and lightning are shining through. Welcome back one more time to Financial Survival. I'm Dave Allen, sitting in for Melody Cedarstrom. Well, Americans' demand for imports abated in April. Failed to mention this at the top of the program, but I think it's an important story coming out of today's newsreels. And that's easing the U.S. trade deficit from the record level it hit the month before. Now, according to the Census Bureau, the goods and services shortfall declined to $69 billion for the month. That's down from the upwardly revised $75 billion in March. That was the highest level stretching back to January 1992. Now, while exports increased 1.1% overall to $205 billion, imports declined by 1.4% to $274 billion, which equated to an 8.2% decline in the trade deficit. Even with the monthly decrease, that still left the trade imbalance 30% higher than the year before, a time when the U.S. economy largely remained in shutdown mode due to harsh restrictions imposed on businesses as part of the pandemic controls. Government bond yields fell following the trade news, as we reported at the top of the program. A declining appetite for imported consumer goods led the import decline. That category fell by $2.5 trillion, largely driven by a $1.7 billion drop in cell phones and other household goods. Automotive vehicles and parts and engines also decreased over $1 billion at a time when the semiconductor shortage has severely hampered production and caused shutdowns at some auto plants. Service imports actually increased $700 million for the month thanks to boosts from travel and transport. The other side of the world, the China trade deficit fell to $32.4 billion. After surging 22% in March. Now, if you missed my blog last Friday, it's entitled Unemployment Falls Below 25%. Yes, 25%. Not below 6, as the government's been reporting. Now, you can sign up for our weekly free weekly newsletters and blogs by going to our website at dgscoins.com, click on the mailbox, and enter your email address. Cue the music. We're pulling out all stops. I woke up this morning hearing "Happy Days Are Here Again" blaring over and over in my ringing ears. Recounting Friday's jobs report, there's no one who can doubt it now, so let the world about it now. Happy days are here again. Happy days are here again. Your cares and troubles are gone. There'll be no more from now on. Happy days are here again. Happy days are here again. Ironically, a year after the band played Milton Eggers and Henry Yellen's classic at FDR's nominating convention, unemployment soared to its Great Depression high of 25%, give or take a tenth or so. Well, it's deja vu all over again. Fast forward nearly a century and unemployment just fell to 25%. Again, give or take a few tenths, if you measure it like they did 30 years ago. Similar to inflation, GDP growth, and other economic metrics, how you measure the unemployment rate matters. It matters to public policy making, to citizens' perceptions of well-being, you name it. If you take the Labor Department's word for it, then you no doubt believe that the headline unemployment rate fell last month from 6.1% to 5.8%, moving it just a little bit closer to the Federal Reserve's loosely defined mandate of full employment. But keep in mind, the government's broader U6 rate, which includes short-term discouraged workers, fell from 10.4% to 10.2%. On the one half, that's about one half less than the 20.7% it was 1 year ago. On the other hand, it's over 70% higher than the rate everyone from the government to the media tells it is. During the pandemic, that rate peaked the U6 at a reported 22.4% in April last year. However, if you start with the more realistic U6 rate, and like shadowstats.com does, add in long-term discouraged workers who literally were defined out of official existence in 1994, the actual unemployment rate is closer to 25%. 25%. In general, job creation disappointed again in May, with non-farm payrolls up what normally be considered a solid 559,000, but still short of loftier economist expectations of 671. May's letdown came after April blew up expectations with the upwardly revised 278,000, still a lifetime away from the initial 1 million estimate that came with high hopes for an economy in a shaky rebound. The employment-to-population ratio, which some Fed officials have cited as an important gauge of labor progress that they look at, did inch higher to 58%, but remained well short of its pre-pandemic level of over 61%. The labor force participation rate, that's another closely followed metric, edged lower to 61.6% as the size of the group fell by 53,000. With more than 100 million American workers remaining on the sideline. That's got to be a typo. I'm thinking that's got to be 10 million. Still, Cleveland Fed President Loretta Mester said that Friday's job report was positive, yet not enough to move the Fed's policy needle. She said, "I view it as progress, but I'd like to see some more." The latest jobs miss comes as a broad swath of employers say a labor shortage is a major reason that they're not attracting more job applicants. Companies believe enhanced unemployment benefits, lack of affordable child care, and ongoing fears about COVID, as we mentioned at the top of the program, are major obstacles to filling 8 million, maybe 9 million vacancies. In short, the U.S. is still about 7 million jobs shy of where it was before the pandemic started. And that's a scenario, of course, that the Fed has repeatedly used for its easy money policies. Yes, all of this is proving, once again, as the singer-songwriter David Byrne would say, same as it ever was. Note to band leader, hold that music for a little while longer, please. We'll get back to you when it's time to strike it back up. Now, our latest American Survival newsletter will hit the streets right after today's program, running a day late this week. This week's edition features a detailed review of last week in the financial markets by Doug Nolan of creditbulletin.com. Also, an essay on future plagues by Wendy Wilson of Apothecary Herbs and an article by yours truly called Goldilocks, Holding On to Gold. Gold continues its recent infatuation with hopscotching from one side of 1900 to the other, often multiple times on the same day, like today. Right now, it's just another kids' game, similar to the children's story of the three bears. where Goldilocks find her taste for a bowl of porridge is not too hot, not too cold. Entered the U.S. economy, which ended last week with a Goldilocks jobs report, according to Invesco chief investment strategist Christina Hooper, anyway. Mixed signals galore, ladies and gentlemen. With the government's May jobs report, the Fed's beige book that followed, and or I guess that preceded it, and other business activity measures, a picture emerged of a rebounding economy, albeit much slower than expected, and one slogged with significant labor and supply shortages. Taken together, more and more saying that the recent data give the Fed cover from changing its course anytime soon, certainly over the next few months at a minimum. Hooper, for one, believes from a market's perspective this is the best possible scenario, the jobs report, that is. She said, we saw enough job creation, but not too much. The too much, I think, refers to ramping up in more inflation worries. As we know, again, the Labor Department reported 559,000 jobs created in May. Now, vaxxed, America isn't yet surging back to work, certainly as quickly as economists hoped it would. They were predicting 670,000. That's 20% more. Still, the total number of jobs rose much faster than the abysmal growth of the month before, as I mentioned a few minutes ago. Plus, pandemic-related unemployment fell sharply, and the number of people who said their employer was closed or lost business because of the pandemic fell by 16% to 7.9 million. That's still a lot, but 1.5 million less than it had been. Investors and market analysts alike have generally been expecting the Fed to begin telegraphing plans for tapering by late summer or early fall. After last week's reports, that hasn't changed. In fact, a few more Fed officials are saying they need to start talking soon about when to start talking about tapering QE infinity. In last Wednesday's beige book release, Fed governors saw increased economic growth compared with earlier in the year, but they also noted stubborn labor shortages and increasing costs for businesses. Sonal Desai, a fixed income CIO at Franklin Templeton, said, it's unusual to see continued slack in the economy with labor shortages that are very clearly being signaled by employers. And it's not just low-skilled jobs, she added. There appears to be a genuine difficulty in finding both unskilled and skilled workers. That's not a good thing. When the June and July jobs and price data show these kinks working themselves out as the nation continues to try to distance itself from the pandemic, that remains to be seen. It's a growing consensus that it will, but there's also some detractors who believe that the rebound is going to level off for a while. In any event, employers believe the May jobs report has provided some reason for them to be optimistic, while others, again, feel it's too early to be confident, particularly about the wage growth picture. Employers have had to raise wages to try to entice workers to come back or to stay. Who knows how much higher they're going to be willing to go. But last month, average hourly earnings did rise 0.5%. That's according to the government. While weekly earnings ticked up just 0.25% over April. Average hourly earnings grew just shy of 3%. For leisure and hospitality jobs, where job growth has been the strongest since March. Two-thirds of those gains were at restaurants and bars, despite widespread employer complaints of worker shortages. After schools reopen en masse this fall, presumably, and enhanced unemployment benefits end in September, unless, again, they're extended by another piece of legislation or by executive fiat, the jobs data then will present a clearer picture of how willing employers are to continue raising wages, and how much easier or difficult it will be at that point for them to attract workers back to the office. New York Times, Benjamin Applebaum says, "My main takeaway from the last two jobs reports is that you can't just flip a switch and turn an economy back on. Recovery is messy," he added, "and it's just going to take more time than anyone would like." Well, that's true. Some, like Melody and I, believe it may not come back, or that it will be a lot longer than the end of this year or next year. I hope in many respects, virtually all respects, that I'm wrong. Otherwise it portends bad news for growing numbers of particularly small businesses and for households who would be facing layoffs and financial problems, if not destitute. So with 7.6 million fewer Americans employed than there were last February at the current rate, that gap's not going to close for at least another 13 months. It's a girl named Goldilocks, ladies and gentlemen out there, doesn't like it too hot or too cold. I think that uncertainty is going to play very well for gold in the coming months. That's it for today's program. It's been a lot of fun bringing you the news and some opinions and commentary. I'll be back on Thursday. Butch will be here tomorrow along with Wendy Wilson of Apothecary Herbs. I'm Dave Allen. Thanks for listening. Please be safe out there. Bye-bye.